Start on time, always. Be on time, always.
Unless, of course, you get stuck in traffic. But if you're late because you didn't roll out of bed, not a good habit to be in.
Because I'm sure once you become big boys and girls, your boss will not sit back and listen to the excuses for too long.
Speaking about someone who had excuses, I give you Charles the First.
He is regarded as one of the most unpopular kings in English history. Why? Well, his wife, his marriage situation, that was a big thing in his time, but by modern standards, you know, that's not necessarily a big deal. But what gets him into trouble with modern historians is this stuff. England had, in its past, kings that wielded authority. But going back to King John, after he was defeated in the Barons' War and had to sign the Magna Carta, the kings going forward, even during the Hundred Years' War, you know, to a degree, they kind of worked with Parliament. Did they always agree on everything? No. Did they have disputes? Yes. But the kings always understood their place. Fast forward to Henry VIII, and suddenly the monarchy gets into religion. That kind of changed the game. But up to the reign of Elizabeth, you know, those issues were solved. Yes, the king technically was the head of the church, but the king is not going to necessarily impose religious will upon the people. Then you have this cat who gets in. He does both. He ignores Parliament, he starts ruling with an iron fist, and he starts basically telling people how to church. And then, to make matters worse, he continued to push the issue. He created an inquisition where people could be called before the Star Chamber and essentially accused not only of heresy, but to a degree, treason. And he told Parliament, go pound sand. I'm doing this myself. Who came in last? There we go. Like someone came in. All right. So what happened? Well, after he disbanded Parliament, he would essentially rule England absolutely for 11 years. This period in English history is known as the Years of the King's Personal Rule. He made the laws, and he executed the laws. He also had tremendous control over the courts to make sure that decisions were made in accordance to his will. He also managed to exploit a huge loophole in the English legal system. Because how did he get his money? If there's no parliament who, under the Magna Carta, has control over the purse, can't tax and spend, how does he basically sustain government? Well, he was clever. He and his advisors went through the whole legal code, and they discovered something that had dated back all the way to the beginning of the Hundred Years' War. And it was a get-around in terms of the restrictions of the Magna Carta. During the reign of Edward III, the king who started the Hundred Years' War, he imposed a demand
on all of the shipbuilding ports in and around England. That if they could not contribute in terms of men, or they could not contribute in terms of money, they could essentially pay their obligation to the war effort by providing ships. So build ships, give it to the crown for free, and you don't have to pay taxes. Well, as the war went on, even shipbuilding became problematic. So Edward III would basically allow that obligation to provide ships to be filled with money or men. And then by the end of the Hundred Years' War, the ship money requirement spread to most industrialized urban centers. So it wasn't just the ports anymore where ships were made, it was any major city or town. They could be required to make this payment for the good of the realm. So why does the king have to demand people contribute personal payments when all he needs to do is call upon all the urban centers to contribute financially? Now, this would be fine had the economy remained level. But of course, there are big time disruptions of economies that suddenly call for the increased demand of government action. The most expensive thing that any government can get into is a war. The Scots are outraged over not only the king's interference in their Calvinist religious traditions, but they're also outraged over the king's use of the Star Chamber. So what did they do in defense of their Presbyterian / Calvinist religion? They raised an army, and they declared war. Now, the king originally used private funds that he had been taking for himself as payment through the ship money process. But unfortunately, the royalist army, once it was built, completely drained his account. So he then had to go to basically the crown's account. And he drained that as well. Knowing how expensive the army was, the king refused to deploy it. Because he actually saw the ledger, how much each individual soldier cost, how much each individual sword and breastplate, and I think they had matchlock muskets and all the equipment, how much it all cost. And the king was like, whoa, no! So how do you win a war if you don't use your army? The Scots, basically, as they had done many, many times throughout their history, kind of declared their independence. They declared they were no longer going to contribute to their king, because Charles technically was their king as well, and threatened invasion. They were going to invade England and start attacking English cities and towns. Being desperate, knowing he needed more money, what does he do? He calls Parliament. He put forth the call, and he puts in a request that they help raise the funds necessary to sustain a war. Well,
Parliament hadn't sat in 11 years. The members that were selected by the different boroughs were very outraged at the antics of the king. So now that legally they could gather, they began demanding rights. They demanded that the king promise to essentially follow the Magna Carta. They wanted full consultation on the taxing and spending of the people. But they also went after the use of the Star Chamber. They demanded the right of trial by jury. No more secret courts. They also demanded something that our founding fathers adopted. The right of habeas corpus. Which is what? What is habeas corpus? I got any criminal justice majors in here? This is the most important protection you have against the government that can basically disappear you. You do realize that, right? Our federal government has the power to make you disappear. All you are is a number in the database. They can seize you. They can make your life cease to be. And they can erase all record of you. But for tiny little constitutional protections. This being the most important. In the Constitution of the United States of America, as in all of the constitutions of all 50 states, somewhere in there is a clause that states the right to issue a writ of habeas corpus shall not be denied. What this right gives you is the ability to petition a judge to go before the court, and it will give you an opportunity to say, the government should not be holding me. Because throughout all of human history, what the governments used to do to people who they found to be pain in the asses is they would seize them and lock them in some dungeon somewhere until they died. That's what he was doing. And so Parliament was like, no. People, even if they are accused of wrongdoing, should have the ability to spend at least a day in court and make the government prove that the person who's there as the defendant actually did something wrong. Not just because the king doesn't like you. Arguably, one of the most important rights you have as an American citizen.
Well, members of Parliament are sending demand after demand after demand after demand, and the king gets pissed.
And that's the reason why this parliament, the session of parliament, is known as a short parliament. They didn't even last a month.
Because as I told you last class, the king has the power to summons parliament, and the king has the power to suspend parliament.
So from mid-April until early May, parliament sitting in session, making all these demands, up until the king says, go home.
Which, legally, he has the authority to do.
But guess what he did not get?
one thing he needed. They didn't pass any spending bills. He got no money. And of course, the irony is that because you have this Great Britain system, Scotland learns of this, and then they publicly declare to the world, not only are we declaring independence, but we need allies to help us keep our independence. At the same time, the Scottish nobles ordered the Scottish army to invade England. They begin marching into the English countryside, looting, pillaging, raping, all of the fun things that the armies used to do not too long ago. Well, the king freaks out. He puts forth a call throughout England and Ireland, both are his kingdoms, that all of the towns should raise their militias to help defend England. Very few communities in England and no communities in Ireland responded to that. He also put forth a call that more towns provide ship money. And most of the towns basically said no. And then he was forced to use his army. The Battle of Newcastle, Northern England. And the Scots wiped the battlefield of the English army. And the crown was forced to sign a treaty. Now, in this treaty, Scotland agreed to allow Charles to still be their king. But they declared that their parliament would have full sovereignty over the laws of Scotland. They also did the same thing that always used to happen when wars ended. The loser paid. So Scotland basically demanded that the crown pay an exorbitant amount of money. Now, call me old-fashioned, but I think that's what it should be. You know how many trillions, I don't know at this point, but how many billions of U.S. tax dollars were wasted trying to rebuild Iraq and Afghanistan? So your mom and dad were out working their asses off trying to put a roof over their head, and the government was taxing them crazy, and we had to pay for all that. We also had to pay for the Ukrainian war as well. We're not even involved in it. I think we should go back to the old-fashioned way. Losers should have to pay. Well, the king loses his army, and he does not have the money to pay. And if he does not pay, Scotland declares their armies are going to come back. And now there's no way to resist. This puts Charles in between a rock and a hard place. He is forced to recall Parliament, and this next session of Parliament, known as the Long Parliament, would be the longest session of Parliament prior to the late 19th century, when Parliament became a full-time legislative body. They would sit continuously for 20 years, from 1640 to 1660. When they gathered, they agreed to raise the funds to pay the Scots to fulfill the requirements of the Treaty of Ripon. But let's think quid pro quo.
What does that mean? Quid pro quo. None of you have ever heard that expression before.
Like, what I do for you, you do something for me.
Exactly.
So Parliament had the king by the gazungas, and they basically said, look, we're raising all this money to cover you. Well, we want things in return. And they began passing bills. The first law that they presented to the king, and the king begrudgingly signed it, was a law known as the Triennial Act. This was a law that would require Parliament to at least meet 3 times a year. So, no more 11 years of no Parliament. And even if the sessions were just a day, that would be fine.
King was like, rrr, 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 but signed it. Then, Parliament demanded that the king end the Star Chamber.
Signed it, fine.
Then Parliament demanded no more ship money, no more other loopholes of feudal raising funds. Why? Magna Carta.
Fine. Charles pledged to recognize the inherent right of Parliament to control the purse.
But then Parliament continued, knowing the position that the king was in. And when they did, the king started to get angry.
In 1641,
Parliament would pass a measure known as the Grand Remonstrance.
Now, the Grand Remonstrance was a list of 208 grievances. A grievance is a complaint.
And in these lists of grievances are all the things that Parliament claimed, or rather the House of Commons claimed, that was wrong with the 11 years of the king's personal rule.
Now, they were careful not to blame the king directly, but rather, they put the blame on all of the advisors of the king. So basically, they believed that the king made the wrong decisions because he was getting bad advice.
But amongst those who the House of Commons held responsible was none other than the Queen.
The House of Commons actually had the audacity to impeach the Queen. Now, FYI, our Constitution does have an impeachment process, but impeachment is not the punishment. Impeachment is the accusation. So when someone is accused, they are impeached. So, when the king sees that his wife is accused of giving her husband bad advice because she is French, because she is Catholic,
the king loses his mind. He begins blaming
all of the conspirators for this insult.
And he begins contemplating action. Well, then, immediately following the Grand Remonstrance, which, by the way, would be vetoed by the House of Lords, so this would never become law. The House of Commons then followed that up with the Militia Bill. This would be a law, if passed, that would restructure how England raised armies.
In the Magna Carta, having a standing army, an army that was always there, professional soldiers, was a violation. So whenever England was threatened, militias had to be called. And they were called,
as I said, borough by borough.
But the person who called for the rising of soldiers was the king as commander-in-chief.
Well, in this bill, if passed, the House of Commons would have that authority. This essentially meant that the House of Commons would have the ability to raise an army to go against the crown.
Well, this was insane.
This too would be vetoed by the House of Lords, but this would be a shot fired across the bow of the king.
Then in January 1642, King Charles would do something that no other monarch ever in the history of England did. He took his personal guards, marched to Parliament, burst into the chamber where the House of Commons met, and would attempt to arrest the five leaders of this cabal. Well, the leaders did get word that the king was coming, and they managed to essentially slip out the back door.
And so the king was forced to leave empty-handed. But have any of you ever been to London before? Okay, you know where Parliament is? It's kind of like on the river. Well, he had to go to where Westminster Palace was. So essentially he had to mark what today is through the big parks that's there, go several city blocks.
Well, as the king is going back to the palace empty-handed, the people of London, outraged by the actions of this abusive tyrant, take to the streets. They began rioting. They began protesting.
The advisors up to the king basically said, "Your Majesty, you're not safe here."
So they put him in a carriage and fled London. They went north to Nottingham. Once he arrived in Nottingham, he began raising an army to attempt to put Parliament into its place. Unfortunately, Parliament would do the same thing.
And at this point, a civil war would erupt.
Northern and Western England sided with the crown. Southern and Eastern England sided with Parliament.
They would each raise armies, and a war would erupt over who has the right to govern.
This is an interesting period of time, that's for sure.
And the battle of warfare was very different than modern warfare.
But the sides were distinct. The loyalist, or the royalist, soldiers were known as the Cavaliers. Why? Well, typically, most of the soldiers were nobles, and they fought as cavalry, and they wore flailing clothes, the big wide brimmed hat with plumage, all that was the style of the day. But the parliamentarians also had their own cavalry, and they became known as roundheads. Why? Well, they wore helmets, generally. Now, besides the cavalry, which was their most glaring feature, both armies kind of were made up the same. Both used militias, so it wasn't originally professional soldiers, and the bulk of the soldiers were infantry, guys on foot. And battles were fought by essentially going out into a field, and you would have opposing lines, and both sides had the same technology. It's the same country, after all. You had guys armed, I love my gun, with matchlock muskets, right? Matchlock, not flintlock at this time, yeah, matchlock muskets. So like an old musket, but the firing mechanism was a slow burning fuse. And so you'd have to light it, and then there would be a pan where you would pour some gunpowder in. After you pour the gunpowder down the barrel and ram down the bullet, which really wasn't a bullet, it was just usually a ball. And so when you would get into the firing position, you would have to hope that your match stayed lit. And then when you'd pull the trigger, an arm would come down and bring the wick to the powder. Well, there was no mechanism to put the right amount of powder in. If you didn't put enough powder in when you pulled the trigger, the gun did not fire. Or if you put too much powder in, there would be a big burst of flame that could like get into your eyes and blind you. Plus, these muskets were smooth tubes. Smooth barrel. So, when you put your ball in there, the ball had to be smaller than the barrel. Because of the heat, if the ball or the barrel expanded, the ball would get stuck in there and the gun would blow up in your hands. So because the ball had to be significantly smaller than the barrel, what it would do, what I'm exaggerating, is it was once fired, it would kind of like bounce down the barrel, which meant it came out. It did not necessarily go straight, but it could be a little high, a little low, and you all did vectors, right? In geometry or math when you were in high school. You know, if you change the angle of a line and you carried it out to the farthest extent, while these muskets were lethal at 300 yards, you could be 10 yards away from someone and shoot way over their head, even though you're pointing right at their face. So that's one of the reasons why both sides had firing lines. You put 500, 600, 1,000 men with guns shooting at guys not that far away. Because chances are 90% of your shots are going to miss. You then supplement your forces with your cavalry, guys on horses. And you use your cavalry to try to kind of crush the enemy's flanks, to make the enemy's lines curl in. That's how, throughout history, battles on battlefields were won. You outmaneuver your enemy. Well, by this time, these tactics using cavalry, I mean, they date back to the ancient Greeks.
But during this time, they had a countermeasure.
You had guys that had long pikes. 8, 10, 12 foot long spears that had either like a sharp point on the end. Sometimes they had a hook. Sometimes they had like an axe blade. And what you would do is in between your guys with guns, you'd have these guys with pikes kind of wedged into the ground. So that way when the cavalry charged, the horses or the riders could be impaled on these pikes. A very violent style of warfare. Well, in the earliest years of the war, because the nobles had been training for war since birth, the loyalist forces initially had the advantage. Until Parliament changed the game. Midway through the Civil War, Parliament would create what became known as the New Model Army. Instead of raising militias, farmers, carpenters, bakers who didn't want to die, Parliament began hiring professional mercenaries, paid soldiers, many of them criminals, pirates, cutthroats, men used to engaging in violence. And this would be a national army. This, by mid-Civil War, would be the force of the parliamentarians. And as time went on, the army grew. At its height, it would have over 25,000 soldiers. Which, by the way, by comparison, most armies during this time period, you'd be lucky if they were more than 6,000. And then out of nowhere, a member of Parliament by the name of Oliver Cromwell, who had the nickname Old Ironsides, would be given full autonomy over this new model army. FYI, two of the most brutal tactics that he deployed. One, he was a cavalryman. So what he did is he used the cavalry unit in the New Model Army, had the soldiers trained. Instead of having individual guys on horses charging at the enemy, he essentially would make a line of cavalry soldiers that would charge together so close that one rider's knee could touch the rider's next to him knee. And what they would do is they would charge directly at where on the line it looked to be the weakest. So even if they did have guys with pikes, maybe on one side or the other, there wasn't as many. That's what he'd target.
But before he charged, he also used tactic number two. Grapeshot artillery. He would use his cannons, and instead of firing a big rock projectile, they'd just throw in chunks of metal, chunks of slate, chunks of small stone. And it would be like a shotgun blast. And you'd basically pepper the lines of the enemy.
As a result, Cromwell began smashing the king's forces, battle after battle after battle.
Then, the new model army began taking loyalist cities and towns, one by one.
Slowly marching its way north. The end came during the siege of Oxford, which took place in late fall 1646. The king had retreated to Oxford because Oxford had some of the thickest defenses out of all of the loyalist cities. But the one thing the king didn't anticipate was the relentless fervor of Cromwell.
They basically began throwing everything they had at the city. They did undermining, where they had sappers come in and dig tunnels under the walls. They would then pack the tunnel with either explosives or pigs. They used pigs because what they would do is they would wall the pigs off and they'd set them on fire. You know how hot pig fat burns? Well, it would cause the ground underneath the wall to expand, and then when the fire went out and it started to cool, the expansion would lead to a collapse of the wall. Well, once they broke in, the king managed to slip out the back,
and he fled all the way up to Scotland, where he still was technically king. And he begged the Scottish, "Give me safe harbor."
Well, the Scots arrested him and basically said to Cromwell, "What would you pay for the king?"
Parliament would send £100,000, which today is the equivalent of about $45 million. They paid the ransom. The king would be turned over, and he would be marched back to London.
Questions? Well, what are you going to do with him? He is your king.
God made him king.
And the Bible does give, not only in the New Testament, but the Old, special recognition to the kings.
But what do you do with them? Well, for 2 years, they began negotiating. They, members of Parliament, basically demanded, you know, that the king recognized more and more rights. We're going to allow you to be on the throne, but you can't basically raise armies again.
And throughout it all, the king never really gave in to many demands.
Plus, on top of it, loyalist strongholds would attempt to rise up again, which meant the new model army was still constantly going out and crushing them. So in the end, Parliament got sick and tired of the game, at least some of the members.
Spearheaded by Parliament, he would return to London, use the new model army, and he began purging Parliament of any member of Parliament that wanted to negotiate with the king.
45 members would be arrested. Another 146 would basically be told, "If you show up to London, we'll kill you on sight." Then the remaining radicals, 75 of them, known as the Rump Parliament, decided instead of negotiating with the king, we're going to put him on trial. The king was charged with treason. The king was also charged with being personally responsible for the deaths of over 300,000 people. All of the people that died in the war. Over 300,000 charges of homicide. But during the trial, the king refused to cooperate. He kept saying, I have sovereign immunity. You can't charge me with these things. I'm the king.
Where does Parliament, in the laws and customs and traditions of England, have the right to put the king on trial? It does not.
So, since the king cannot be found guilty of legal wrongs, why are we here? Well, you know what the members of the Rump Parliament did? They simply said to the king, "We are not holding the office of the king responsible. We're holding the man currently in the office responsible."
The trial lasted 5 days.
In the end, of the 68 members of Parliament who sat as the court, 59 of them would hold the king as being guilty. And they would sign his death warrant. And on January 30th, 1649, something that had never happened before in the history of a European country, a king was held guilty of crimes against the people, by the people, and sentenced to death. The king would lose his head to an axeman on January 30th, 1649. Questions?
But now what? Okay, unprecedented. Never happened before. Now what do we do? Do we bring in his son
and put his son on the throne? That's what usually happens when a king dies. But then do we want his son? Do we even have a say over his son of this succession? Again, divine rights of kings. We've always had a monarchy. We probably should have a monarchy.
Well, England would enter an interesting time.
Beginning in 1649, lasting until 1660, England would enter a period that modern historians refer to as the interregnum. The period in between kings. Following the regicide, the murdering of the king, Parliament decided we're not going to have a monarchy. But rather, we're going to create a new form of government, which they called the Commonwealth.
FYI, Massachusetts is a commonwealth. We are a state that has no nobility, no monarchy in charge.
But a commonwealth is an old English way of referring to what Rome used to have, a republic. So the idea was, as you separate the powers of the king, you give the lawmaking authority to Parliament, And instead of having a monos arken, a single ruler, you create an executive council to serve as the executive body. This would be known as the Council of State. This would be a 15-member council chaired by Oliver Cromwell.
And this council would basically execute the laws passed by Parliament.
But Cromwell, unfortunately, would not be able to be in London for the first 4 years because all throughout the realm, there was continual uprisings. Charles II, son of the King of Charles I, would land in Scotland. Scotland would recognize him as their king, and they would attempt to raise an army.
Cromwell learns about this. He marches north, crushes the Scots. Young Charles is forced to flee.
He then learns that once a bunch of loyalist soldiers found out that King Charles was recognized in Scotland, they wanted to have Charles as the English king, so they raised an army. Cromwell turned around and went and laid siege to and leveled the city of Worcester and destroyed that loyalist army. Well, while all this is going on, Ireland sits back and says, well, now's the time for us to get our independence. So they rebel, declare their independence. So Cromwell takes the New Model Army, marches over to Ireland, and if you know anything about Irish history, Cromwell essentially would perpetrate genocidal crimes from 1651 to 1653. He brutally crushed the rebellion, killing close to 500,000 people. Men, women, children. And then, once he was done, he returned to London and said, No. This Commonwealth system, this is stupid. I get the army behind me. And in 1653, he declared he would create a military dictatorship, making himself the Lord Protector of England.
Now, he allowed Parliament to remain, but he got rid of the Council of State.
Now, during the Lord Protector.
Now, over the next 6 years, we have to be fair. Was he a brutal dictator? Absolutely. But peace was restored in England.
For the most part, he left the existing structure alone. He didn't try engaging in socialism. He didn't want to redistribute land, redistribute wealth. He didn't attack titles. He didn't attack nobility.
He did get himself in a little bit of trouble. Sticking his nose into religion.
Because Cromwell was a Puritan.
Now, Puritans appeared during the reign of Elizabeth, and what they focused on was essentially removing any remnants of Catholicism out of the Church of England. They wanted to purify it, to perfect it.
But the problem was there was a lot of people in England that were resistant to it. Particularly when he began attacking the Episcopalian structure of the Church of England. Bishops, you know, having the hierarchy. He wanted to go more with a Presbyterian model. And a lot of people didn't like that. But no one raised a finger against him because he had the army as his personal military force.
One of the last acts that he did was he got Parliament to give him a position for life, which would come to an end in 1658.
But before he died, he tried convincing his son Richard to assume the position of Lord Protector, making it a hereditary title that could be passed on from father to son. Sounds like a monarchy. But Richard, after seeing of all the brutal acts that his father engaged in, he wanted nothing to do with it.
So, with having no executive, Parliament in 1660 decided, let's bring back the king.
They would reach out to Charles the Younger, who was living in France, and they would invite him to come and be King of England. And talk about knowing history. Obviously, he knew what happened to his old man. He knew exactly what caused the tensions that resulted in the losing of the head.
So when he became king, you know what he decided to do? Let's collaborate.
He accepted that Parliament would be the legislative branch. He stopped trying to issue decrees. He never attempted absolutism.
So everything seemed to go well.
To make matters even better, he was dedicated. He was hardworking. It was said, it was very frequent of the king to work 7 days a week, to put in 16, 18, sometimes 20 hours a day, working for the good of the land. Meeting with members of Parliament, understanding the intricacies of the bills, you know, trying to make sure that all was being taken care of. He also would reestablish the Episcopalian structure of the Church of England, which was taken down during the interregnum. He brought back the bishops and the archbishops. But he did not pass any religious rules. He allowed the church to control the religion.
He also was an effective war leader. They would fight a war.
In 1664, against the Netherlands. They would beat the Dutch, and he would take as a prize the Dutch colony of New Amsterdam. Does anyone know where New Amsterdam was? Any of you from New York? New York and New Jersey was once the colony of New Amsterdam. It wasn't just the English over here in North America. There were Dutch, there were Swedes, there were French.
Well, after defeating the Dutch, he took New Amsterdam, and he would give it to his brother, James, the Duke of York.
And James would name the territory the name that it's still known by today, New York.
He also established the mercantile rules. All of the rules and regulations of trade between the English colonies in North America and the motherland,
known collectively as the Navigation Acts. They said who could trade, who could transport, what could be traded, what couldn't be traded, all of the laws of trade. Now, the only clash that he had with Parliament, and he really didn't push it that far, was his desire to restore the rights of the people who kind of identified as Catholics.
Now, under the reign of Elizabeth, you could be a Catholic if you wanted to. This was true under the reign of James.
But under the reign of Charles, he started kind of pushing it a little more. Until the interregnum. And then they lost everything. So Charles, FYI, being raised in France, born of a Catholic mother, and by the way, you all, if you're Catholics, you should know that in Catholic tradition, it's the religion of the mother that is passed on to the religion of the children.
So he was a Catholic, and this was seen as a way of maybe trying to bring England back to the Catholic world.
But he was like, no. I just want equity. I just want everyone to be treated the same. Parliament essentially said no, and he said, okay, fine.
He didn't want to lose his head, after all. Again, I don't know how strong-willed any of you are, but there are going to be times in life when you're going to get in arguments, and you're going to push for things that you want. Have you ever had any instance where there was something that you wanted so much you're willing to get your head cut off for?
Yeah, I didn't think so. So, he would reign successfully from 1661 all the way up until 1685, when he died. But lo and behold, when he died, he had no legal heir. Why? Well, as it turns out, he absolutely hated his wife. Couldn't stand her. They were rarely seen in the same building together, let alone doing the extramaritals that are necessary to sustain a dynasty. But he wasn't homosexual. He loved women as much as Henry VIII did. He slept with dozens and dozens and dozens of women and had a total of 11 bastard children that were alive at the time he died. But the problem was is they were illegitimate and they could not get the throne. So when he died, the throne would pass to his brother. The Duke of York, who would be crowned James II. We'll give you a little intro on James, and then we'll call it a class. Now, it is said that Charles II was more like his grandfather, James I. Whereas his younger brother, James II, was more like their father, Charles I. When he came to the throne, though, whereas England was like, when Charles I became king, when James ascended, there actually was good feelings because no one died. There was no bloodletting. It was a peaceful transfer of power. Parliament recognized him as the legitimate heir. They passed all the laws that allowed for him to become king. They had the nice ceremony in Westminster Abbey. All of the stuff that you're supposed to do. There was a problem. Like I said, he was more like his father than his grandfather. He boldly stated that he was a Catholic. He didn't try hiding it. But to make matters worse, he also came of age in France, in the palace of his cousin, Louis XIV, the Sun King, who we're going to talk about next class. So he gets to the throne and he's like, yeah, I want to have all the power. I want to be viewed as the life-giving force of the sun, just like my cousin Louis. Yeah. So what does he do? He does not bring Parliament into the loop, like his brother did. And instead, he brings over a group of Catholic and French advisors. Not a good move. He also filled any position only with people who were Catholics. Not a good decision. Ironically, there would be actually rebellion. Small rebellions. He then quickly built an army modeled on the new model army. But when the rebellions were crushed, he doesn't suspend the army. Instead, he continues to pay the soldiers and encourage them to engage in training. Why did he want a standing army? Well, in order to be an absolutist, you have to have a standing army. Which kind of makes Parliament concerned. He then began trying to bend the laws, look for loopholes, and eventually you would begin to outright ignore Parliament. Bless you. Which, of course, had many people in Parliament saying, is the king going to violate the Triennial Act? Is the king going to suspend Parliament and try to engage in years of personal rule again? But the people remembered the violence and death of the Civil War. They knew what had happened two generations before, when for nearly 20 years, armies were marching around England, men were killing men, and women and children were getting caught up in it. Hundreds of thousands of people died. They were like, okay, the king's being a pain in the butt. But we don't have a problem because he does have two heirs, two daughters, who are both Protestant. So when he dies, it's no big deal. We'll just bring in one of the daughters and we'll go back to being a Protestant country. And I mention that because ultimately this would be the most crucial element of his reign. In 1687, he sought to pass a decree that would make it illegal for Parliament to impose punishments on Catholics, regardless of the allegation. So some members of Parliament are like, what, we're going to allow Catholics to literally get away with murder?
Then when Protestants started protesting, he called out his army. and chased him away. It got so bad that annually, around Christmas time, the king was allowed to send a message to the Church of England, and all of the message was to be read in all of the churches and parishes around the land. Well, in 1688, the Anglican Church said, no, we're not going to share the king's annual message.
But they're waiting on the clock. He's going to die. He's going to die. He's going to die.
Until on June 10th, 1688, his second wife, Mary, who unlike his first wife was a Protestant, his second wife was a Catholic. So he would give birth to a son named James, who was baptized in the Catholic religion. And this caused Parliament to freak out, because now we're potentially going to have a Catholic dynasty.
And at that point, and this is the last click of the day,
in 1688, a revolution would erupt in England, known as the Glorious Revolution. Questions. All right. A couple of things before you go. Exam number 3. I'm almost there. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get through everything I got left on Thursday. If I can't, we'll finish on Tuesday, and then we'll start the stuff for the final, and then we'll give you the exam next week. But if I do get through it, that means your exam number 3 is going to be over the weekend. 2, papers are due April 22nd. If you haven't even started it, you might want to. If you're almost done, get it done. None of you dropped it in early, so none of you got early submission bonuses. But you could still get it out of the way. The Dropbox isn't engaged. But before you process your paper, make sure you go to prophylmanic.com, go to the paper section, read how your paper's going to be graded. I'm not grading you like an English professor. I'm not an English professor. I'm grading you in a manner that requires you to follow my directions. And you'll be penalized for every part of my directions you do not follow. So if you are capable of following directions, even if you're not a good writer, you should still get a decent grade. If you go, when you go through that, if you have any questions about anything on there, bring it to class and ask. I told you on day one, I'm not going to keep the rubric or whatever you want to call it secret. I will explain anything on there. But if you don't ask, I'm going to assume that you're good and you'll be held accountable. Last but not least, as I've said a bunch of times, several of you still have perfect attendance. Keep it going. Some of you have used 2 or 3 absences, you're okay. But those of you who have missed more than 4 classes, attendance penalty, as is outlined in the syllabus. So if you've missed classes, don't miss any more. Questions? Dismissed!